It is well accepted that Jaws is an all-time great film, but its progeny don't rank nearly as high. Two True Freaks is proud to present Is It Jaws, where Paul Spitero and Sean Whalen are joined by an all-star list of guest hosts to review old and new films and place them on the Jaws scale, where they're ranked from Jaws to Jaws 4. Of course, for the purposes of the show, that scale does take some liberties with their actual ratings. Sure, movies that are given the ranking of Jaws are considered classic films with few flaws, if any. A ranking of Jaws 2 indicates that the film is very good and worthy of repeated viewings. A Jaws 3 ranking indicates the film was okay, but that's all. A Jaws 4 means it's ranked as a bad movie. Oh, and if you ever saw Back to the Future Part 2, you know that there's a Jaws 19. That ranking indicates that the movie is so incredibly bad that it's actually fun to watch as a result. So please join Paul and Sean as they ask the ever-important question, is it Jaws?
Is the greatest picture I have ever made. And I've got the angle on the trailer. Boys, we've got to get across to the public that that picture has everything. Why, it's hilarious. It's romantic. It's tender. It's charming. It's delightful. It's exciting. And it's groovy.
Yes.
Yes, Mr. Schaefer.
That does it, boss.
Mr. Schaefer, you've got a great idea.
Naturally. Now, I'll tell you what we do.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to Is It Jaws? And shortly, in a few days, Merry Christmas. So, I'm Paul Spitero, and I'm here with my good buddy, Mr. Sean Whalen. Merry Christmas, Sean.
Merry Christmas, and it's a pleasure to be here.
And we are doing a Christmas movie today, and two of my favorite Christmas movie people are Darren and Ruth Sutherland, who are joining us here today.
Happy Christmas.
Merry Christmas to both of you. So happy to be back chatting with both of you.
And today we're taking a look at Miracle on 34th Street. We're going to look at the 1947 version. That's our primary talk. But I also want to go in a little bit on some of the remakes that have come out over the years. One theatrical release and three television remakes. And I'm not sure how familiar everybody is with all of those remakes. So, you know, we're not going to go in depth on any of them, but we're going to talk a little bit about that after we finish talking about the original classic. Now, this was a Christmas staple in my home. We watched it every year. I think in the last few years, because there's just so much content for Christmas, I think we've probably fallen into an every other year viewing on this as opposed to every single year. There's certain ones that we have to watch every year. Every year we watch It's a Wonderful Life. Every year I watch The Muppet Christmas Carol. Every year I watch Elf. This one's kind of like every other year now, but I think it belongs in that group and it should probably be every year. And we watched it again the other night just for the sake of doing the show. And I'm not going to bury the lead. I think this is a wonderful Christmas movie. And, you know, we'll talk about details as we go on. Sean, how about you?
So, strangely enough, I was under the impression that I've seen this before. I've seen lots of clips. I knew the premise of the story, you know, just because of conversations throughout the years. In watching this, I realized I'd never seen this from start to finish before. This is actually my first viewing of Miracle on 34th Street. And I got to say, with it being 2024 and I'm watching this for the first time, I think it's a real good litmus test on how this holds up. I really enjoyed it start to finish. It was engaging. The pace is incredible. I mean, so I know I'm not burying the lead on it, but I think this is going to be a really fun film to talk about. I think why this is such an special movie.
That's awesome. I love hearing that, Sean, to have that fresh perspective. And I know what you mean. You can fall into that trap of you sort of have absorbed a movie and think you've seen it, but you haven't. So how cool is that?
Kind of the the Mandela effect. How about you guys, Darren, Ruth? How has this fallen in your viewing scope?
Well, this is definitely one of our all-time favorite Christmas movies, and you named a couple of the others, Paul. It's a Wonderful Life, which I know we've talked about. That is probably my all-time favorite Christmas movie, and I'm glad you mentioned the Muppet Christmas Carol. That's a delightful one. Elf, you know, interesting. Elf, I remember really liking, and I'm such a Bob Newhart fan, and so I remember it well. But I can't remember the last time I watched Elf. But I would say this and Miracle on 34th Street and Muppet Christmas Carol are always on our watch list around Christmas. We probably don't watch them every year, but we watch them frequently at Christmas.
Yeah, they are delight with such a heart. Like, I always, you know, feel good watching this film and always enjoy revisiting it around the holidays.
So now, you know, as I said, I've watched this since as long as I can remember. You know, I started watching it as a young child, and I couldn't tell you the first year I saw it. I couldn't give you any, you know, like any kind of background. I have a specific memory of probably being about 7 years old and being at one of my aunts and uncles' houses and watching it with my cousins, who were all significantly older than I am. So I was seven. They were probably 12, 13 years old watching it. And I remember them just kind of explaining the legal moments to me in, you know, in the way that an understanding of a 12 or 13 year old would be. So it's, you know, there were all sorts of things going on.
Yes,
I did start the recording. So like I said, I just remember it being like a constant. And this is the first time that I watched it for the purposes of reviewing it, of actually critiquing it. And I'm going to throw up my one really nitpick of a criticism, because I only have one in the whole movie. And that was, as I was watching it this time, I was looking at Edmund Gwenn, who played Kris Kringle. And, I mean, he did an incredible job. He really just embodied that role. And yet, the one thing that I thought could have been done better is that as they directed this, I think they could have used a little bit more creative angles or whatever to make him look a little bigger and burlier. Because as I was watching it this time, and again, this is the first time I'm noticing this at all in probably the 50 times I've seen this movie, but he looked smallish, and he didn't look as, you know, as big and boisterous as Santa Claus should be to me. And that's, again, it's a nitpick of a criticism, because it's never even registered to me before. But trying to look at it again for critiquing version, that's the only thing I came up with as a negative.
That's really interesting that you mentioned that, Paul, because Ruth commented during the movie that we commented several times about how some things have stayed the same and some things have changed since this movie was made. And one of the things she commented on was that he seemed very small and not really very large for a Santa Claus. And we were talking about how, you know, it's like that, maybe that image of Santa changed, maybe this 1947, because, you know, not that long after the war, not that long after the Great Depression, you know, everyone's sort of smaller. So maybe, you know, this somewhat smallish, svelte Santa still, you know, just seemed different of enough for them, but doesn't seem quite so much for us now. I did notice, yeah, that they had him gain 30 pounds for the role, but he still looks, you know, fairly svelte for a Santa Claus by today's standards, and certainly rather short as well, as you mentioned.
I agree with all of that. What was interesting to me is I actually thought that set him apart as being the real Santa Claus. Just because we're always seeing people in costumes and, you know, he's actually replacing somebody in a costume. I agree actually with, and I can see how it'd be one of those things where it's either you feel it or you don't. I actually really like the fact that he felt different from a traditional costume wearing Santa Claus.
And nice perspective.
It kind of worked for me.
Yeah. I like hearing that.
Early on in the movie, when the actual Santa Claus that the department store hired is drunk, and I'm trying to remember the name of the actor who played him,
Percy Helton.
Yes, who's another one of these guys who you've seen in 100 things. you know, he keeps coming back to me as. A very, very small part that he had in Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. But anyway, you know, he was drunk and he needed to be replaced. And then when Maureen O'Hara saw Edmund Gwynn, she was like, oh, you look perfect for the part. And that, like, that means to me he should have been bigger and burlier. He should have looked more perfect. But just the same, again, it's such a nitpick that I can't really dwell on it too much.
I love that you... recognize Percy Helton's voice as well. For people like us who watch a lot of these old classic movies, I mean, he certainly was a very common character actor. I didn't even remember that he was in this. And then as soon as I heard his voice, I told Ruth, I said, oh, that's the guy from the Get Smart episode where he invents the silent explosive.
That's an example of exactly what I was talking about, that he's somebody you've seen in 100 things, and whichever one comes to your mind is going to be the interesting thing. So, just to, I guess we'll stick with Edmund Gwynn's performance for a moment. Now, I'm not actually familiar with him in anything else. I don't recall, I've probably seen him in other things, but I don't specifically recall it. And I didn't look at his filmography, which I'm going to just kind of open up now. Do any of you have any familiarity with him beyond this movie?
It's interesting that you mentioned that, because this is always what I know him from. I did read a little bit about him, and it was interesting, you know, reading about his long stage career that, like, started in the 1890s. So he was very well known in stage plays. But then he just sort of ended up eventually becoming a frequent character actor. And this was the movie that made him a star. So, but it's interesting. They talked about how, you know, he did so many things as a character actor before and then so many things as a character actor after. But I guess it's those things he can just morph into anyone. And of course, he's 30 pounds heavier here than we would normally see him. So, but I didn't recognize him or remember him right off from anything else either, Paul. But apparently he was a very well-known Shakespearean actor in London.
Yeah, I opened up his filmography and there's a couple of titles that I recognize, but nothing that I specifically either know him from, or there's some I recognize the title, but I don't know if I've ever actually seen them. So I couldn't even say how big his part was in any of these movies. It does say something about him being in 4 Alfred Hitchcock movies. I see The Trouble with Harry on his list, but I didn't see any of the others offhand. But again, just this performance alone, I don't know if he's a great actor, but I certainly know he gave us a great performance in this movie. He's warm. The conviction of his beliefs really comes through. And as you watch it, you start saying, yeah, I believe this guy is Santa Claus. You know, and that's
absolutely,
which is exactly what you need from this performance.
It's so nice that you mentioned that, because that's, I think that was one of the quotes I read from Maureen O'Hara. that she commented that as the movie was being made, it's just sort of like over time, the entire cast and crew just came to accept that he was really Santa Claus because his real life personality was just like that. He was just very, you know, loving and kind and matter of fact. And so she said it was almost like the production was just like the movie. Everybody was convinced he was the real Santa Claus by the end.
The notes did say that he and Natalie Wood developed a very close relationship as this was filming because of that persona that he had. Nice. You know, I mean, obviously she didn't in real life believe he was Santa Claus. She was old enough to know that he was an actor and they were in a movie together. But I think that avuncular persona just came through and they developed a close relationship.
That's sweet to hear.
Yeah, that is nice to hear. I'm glad you read that.
I like that he didn't play it over the top.
Yes.
Because I think you can take characters like Santa Claus that are big and things like that. And I think we're used to seeing this nowadays with animated adaptations and things where, and there's nothing wrong with it. You have to be like this huge, big presence. And I think what really worked off of this is that he didn't do that. I felt like we got to see his emotional range based on everything that was going on around him and his reaction to it. But nothing was overdone where he felt cartoony. And I think that helped make him feel much more authentic, you know, especially when you've got a department store Santa Claus that he's replacing who was appropriately over the top because of the situation. Then you see him come in there and he felt like a fully realized real person. And I thought that was a great choice in a day and age. I think where we're used to seeing the big character being somebody who is like almost aggressively powerful. This one, it felt like you were hanging with Santa Claus, which I think is, it made it very charming.
It's a really nice point, Sean, because he does play the character and not the caricature. So really insightful. I hadn't thought about that, but yeah, you're right. Because sometimes he's very quiet and insightful. And then sometimes, you know, what, he's never really, you know, in your face Santa Claus. He's just always, you know, subtly coming through as that. So very different point.
Yeah, I don't think they could have done much better in their casting of this role. And we'll talk a little bit about that as we talk about some of the remakes and who they had play Santa in those, because I think it's interesting to see the casting in those movies. Maureen O'Hara recently came up with me. I follow the TCM page on Facebook, and I often share their postings on the Is It Yours page just because I find them to be just fun. Just, you know, enjoying the old movies. But there recently was one where they asked, you know, which actor, or can you name an actor who by their very presence lifts up a movie and makes it better? And I've often said Gene Hackman, Robert Duvall have never been in a movie where I thought they gave a bad performance. You know, I think they've been in bad movies, but I don't think they ever gave a bad performance. And I listed Gene Hackman, Robert Duvall, and Michael Caine. And I thought, well, you know what? It's really not fair. I'm giving all actors. I should give a couple of actresses, too. So I gave it some thought. And the two that I came up with were Maureen O'Hara and Olivia de Havilland. I don't think I've ever seen a bad performance out of either of them. In fact, I'm not 100% sure I've ever seen a bad movie with either of them. But I you know, the performances have always been top-notch. So Maureen O'Hara, right off the bat, is, in my opinion, excellent in this movie. And then, again, viewing this for the sake of critiquing it, in my mind, I started to compare her to her performance in The Quiet Man, which is actually the first movie Sean and I ever reviewed together, and how different that character was and how different the performance was, which really made this stand out even more so in my mind. I can review it on its own merits, and I came up with, you know, a really strong opinion of it. But then when I compare it to that, and now I'm seeing the range that she has, that even meant more to me. And I just, again, top notch.
That's
great to hear you have a chance to compare and contrast with that other movie. So I appreciate hearing it.
Yeah, no, I wish I had time maybe to watch something else with her for that reason. I mean, I know her name immediately and I've seen her in many things, but I haven't seen her in anything recently enough to be able to compare the performance. So that's nice to hear.
I mainly know her as a frequent John Wayne co-star. John Wayne, Maureen O'Hara are like Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall. Not that, I mean, they were never married as Humphrey Bogart and Lauren Bacall were, but when you think about the movies, the names go together the same way.
Well, she was almost in this one with John Wayne. It just missed by one letter.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It took me a second to realize. Yeah, John Payne played Fred Gailey. And
be interesting to see what the casting order was for that.
And just to go to him, I thought he gave a very good and understated performance. And I think, you know, Sean, you mentioned before about Edmund Gwynn not overplaying it, you know, being a little bit more subtle. And I think for the most part, the main characters in this movie all have that attribute in this movie. And I think John Payne does that as well. And the big key to me is I think you can feel some chemistry between him and Maureen O'Hara because they don't really have romantic scenes in the movie until you get to the end and you see that, you know, they're going to plan to get married and buy this house together and live together. But there's not a lot of romance that's going on, but there is a chemistry that you can feel the relationship even though you're not seeing the scenes. And I think that's important to the movie.
I love that you mentioned that, too, and that both of you brought up the understated performances, because that's so absolutely true, because you can see, for instance, in John Payne, you can see the hesitation in how he pulls back sometimes. It's like he wants to try to push a little harder to get into a relationship with her, but he'll pull back because it just seems very realistic. And you're right with her about how subtle she changes. It's like she has her beliefs at the beginning and you see them slowly change. And it's not like she goes from one far end of the pendulum to the other, but you can tell that she swung from just, you know, one side to the other side slowly over the course of this movie. And that's brought out so well when she just, you know, signs the little extra bit on the note. Her daughter's note at the end. And it's, you're right. It's like they're all subtle performances and we don't get a lot of that anymore. And I really love that you both brought that out because I hadn't thought about that.
Part of the birth of the relationship too was the fact that his relationship with the daughter was, part of it was him wanting to meet her. And mm-hmm. we actually got to see the birth of a relationship here. And that was something that I thought like felt very natural, because even his reading the room, as far as the, you know, she wants the daughter to stay very rooted in reality and we're not going to believe and we're going to be very honest and those type of things. He's trying to help this kid to be rounded, like almost learning play and having an appropriate childlike life. And he's recognizing that this is something he has to navigate in a very subtle and careful way. He does a lot through facial expression in reaction mm-hmm. to what's going on around him that I thought was really well acted in this, mm-hmm. To the point of the subtle pieces. Just I thought was strong acting, because, again, that felt very real. It felt like you were these were friends that they became in the film. And I think that was also part of the joy of this film, was the fact that everyone's very likable. And sometimes that can be boring. You know, you're like looking for this like intense conflict, and there is in the film. And I like those pieces, but it's the scenes where it is them just getting to know each other and them just living life are really, really terrific and really, really enjoyable and worth watching. Like, this is, I can see why this for so many is a comfort food film, where you want to hang out with these people and be around them, because I could see in a lesser script that not being as interesting as it was in this. And these people are very interesting.
Yeah,
I agree. You make a lot of good points there. I think how those acting choices are made and how they come across for their performances really do end up making you feel like these are believable people and situations, and this is the conversation they're having and the decisions they're making as they go forward. So it just really draws me in.
Yeah, it's like you're just naturally, you're on the fly on the wall hearing a conversation instead of having a play performed in front of your face.
Very true. I want to back up a little bit because I forgot to mention what I feel is one of the key moments in this movie, and I just let it go by because we were talking about Edmund Gwynn's performance. The scene with the young Dutch girl is so incredibly touching when you really watch it closely. And again, this is something that kind of I just accepted as, you know, oh, look, see, he's a wonderful Santa Claus, blah, 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 when I was just watching it on its own. But when I was watching it with more of an eye of how did they put this together? How did they make you care about these characters? How did they make you feel that this is really Santa Claus? Now, the story, they give you very little, but the background story on that little girl is she's an orphaned girl from the Netherlands, and she's brought to America. She does not speak English. She's, you know, the woman who brings her over is not her mother because she's an orphan. So she's from an orphanage, and, you know, she hasn't responded to anyone, but she really wanted to see him because she saw him at the parade and, you know, made it, I guess, somehow made it known that that's the case. And then when he just all of a sudden starts speaking to her in Dutch and they start singing together and you see her face light up. And I'm going to get to this in a moment with Natalie Wood, but I hold child actors to a lesser standard than I do adult actors because you're usually getting a wooden performance out of them. You can only expect so much. But the way her face lights up, it gives me a little bit of a goosebump just to think about it. It was such a wonderful scene, and it really just gives you the emphasis on why this is Santa Claus.
I love that scene as well. And in reading a little bit more about some trivia for the movie, I was blown away when I found out what the translation was of that, you know, Dutch conversation. And I found out that Kris Kringle had asked her what she wanted for Christmas. And she said she didn't want anything because her gift was being adopted and finding a home. And oh, that was just so moving. And it made me wonder, like, why didn't they subtitle that so I could know it when I was watching the film? That was just there. And only if you knew the Dutch language could you, like, be in on what that conversation was. It was just so heartwarming.
And that just gives me more chills now knowing that because I didn't. That's great. Well, I'm glad you looked that up.
It was a treat when I found that. It's like, oh, I cannot believe this. I just thought it was a little, you know, chit chat and nice, you know, connecting moment between the child and Santa. And then to hear that sort of serious and grateful exchange was amazing.
I was blown away when Ruth told me about that translation too, because I just assumed, well, they didn't bother to translate it because it's, you know, she's asking for a doll or something like that. And he's, you know, answering back. And because you think, well, they didn't translate it, so it's not important. And then it's so important. And I'm so glad Ruth found that translation.
The other scene where I think you really start to get a feel for Edmund Gwynn as Santa Claus is, or the other scenes are when they show his relationship with Alfred, who's shown to be, you know, I think I'm reading between the lines a little bit, but you see him as a little bit, you know, slow-witted. I don't know that he's necessarily got any issues, but he's clearly uneducated. And he just loves playing Santa for the kids. He loves the whole Santa thing. And you know, Kris Kringle takes him in. And, you know, and like that's the only thing that spurs him to actually show that moment of violence when he bops the psychiatrist on the head with his cane, or with his umbrella, rather. But, you know, there's a lot shown there, you know, as it's developing. And his outrage at what he's being told that, you know, that he's got these issues. And then at the end, when he's there at the little party that they have, there's you know, a bond there that's, I think, also essential to the movie to show that character and what he's like in real life, as well as his relationship with the, I guess, main person at the senior citizen home where he's living, and you know, his just belief in, you know, he doesn't believe he's Santa, but he believes that he's just a wonderful person and should be treated as such. And I just, you know, I think these are all things that just add to the development of the character.
Yeah, that's, I'm glad you brought him up, because I hadn't made any notes about him, but every scene with him is just, you know, very touching. He, again, another understated performance and completely believable, because you sort of, he's just a hardworking, quiet guy, and he has this one thing he looks forward to that gets taken away, and it's like they don't overplay any of it again, but you know, it means so much to him, and Chris certainly knows that and realizes that, and it's there's some really nice scenes there.
It kind of bookends the drunken Santa too, you know, in the you've got that character who he's so outraged by and like appalled by him not taking the responsibility seriously, and you've got Kris Kringle like seeing this other person that like I can mentor, this is, you know, you can really keep, you know, the whole spirit of Christmas thing going. It was kind of cool to see the different interactions with people portraying him, even, which was kind of cool.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and his desire, you know, the movie opens up with him helping the store operator, you know, change the reindeer to the right order because they, you know, they're not right, as if anyone else would notice it. But he feels strongly that, you know, this is all real and it should be portrayed as real. And it's, you know, I think it all goes to the character, and it's great. I mentioned already Natalie Wood. I think, I don't know of anything that she did before this. I think this was her premiere. You know, I know of stuff not too long after this. I mean, because I've seen The Searchers that she was in probably about 10 years later as a teenager. And then I've seen stuff, you know, starting with West Side Story and after that. But they must have known early on what talent this young girl had, because I watch this movie and I'm looking at her reactions to things that are going on. I'm not just looking at how she delivers her lines, which is the first level of competence to an actor, is being able to deliver their lines well. But then when you start going beyond that, you're seeing how they react, how they show emotion, and how they look when someone else is speaking. Are they just standing there and staring and waiting for their line to come up, or are they showing the emotion to what that person is saying? And I see it in her much more so than I ever recall seeing in an actor or actress of her age in this movie. So I, you know, looking at it again as a critic, I was really, really impressed with her performance here.
I couldn't agree more. We've talked about the, you know, understated and realistic performances of all of the adults, but the honest truth of the matter is, if you didn't have a good wild actor in this role, it would break this movie, because you would no longer be sucked in and believe this is all real if you had an unbelievable, you know, a child actor in the role. And she is absolutely magnificent. Ruth and I both talked about that as we went through. Ruth brought it several times when she's in the background and her facial expressions are changing and her eyes are darting back and forth as she's listening to the other characters in the scene talk. And she's just perfect. And you're right. So many times, you know, kids are put in movies just because they're cute and, you know, people will go aw and all that sort of stuff. But here you've got to have a child actor who can play a range of emotions. And boy, does she ever, because she's terrific in this role.
To the point of what I said earlier about there not being a lot of extremes in this film, what you don't have is a child here who has like this horrible life or anything like that.
Mm.
Yet you're driven to want her to believe. Mm. I mean, which is really intriguing. I mean, she's got a good mom. She's got a good life. She's a very likable kid right from the get-go. But yet there's that something that's missing. And I thought that was a triumph of the film, too, because so often you need that extreme in order to kind of, I guess, push the audience to feel something emotionally. I like that they didn't do that. And I like that they got this kid with this wonderful chemistry with all of the leads and were able to still, I wanted her to believe. And I think that is something to make that happen when you don't have this kid who's got, yeah, you want her to believe because you know that's just going to make her life so much better and things like that. I believed that. but I didn't believe it because of the fact that she had like a horrible upbringing. She had a wonderful mother. And I thought that was, it was such a cool way to deliver it. I think so makes the story unique that I was still rooting for her to believe in Santa Claus and kind of adopt that Christmas spirit without having the over the top extreme of, oh my God, this kid will be saved from their horrible childhood because of this. I think it was a very different touch that added to the charm of this movie, because you need John Payne's character to be likable. You need Maureen O'Hara's character to be likable. So you can't make her life horrible, but yet we still delivered this desire for her to believe in Kris Kringle and the mother to believe in Kris Kringle. And I think Natalie Wood is the glue that holds all of that together. She was great in this.
So there are basically three child performances that have some significance in this. We had the Dutch girl, we had Natalie Wood, which is obviously the one, and then we had one that was more minor, but I thought it was significant, and I enjoy it even though it's not at the acting level of what we've talked about, and that's the DA's son when he takes the witness stand. He delivers his lines like he's, you know, memorized them, but I think that's forgivable in this because he's whatever he's supposed to be, 6 years old, 5 years old, and he's being put on the witness stand at a trial. So you would think he, you know, and this is a kid who, you know, is clearly enjoying the spotlight. So the fact that he delivers his lines that way are okay, and it doesn't take you out of the movie at all, because you still don't feel like he's reading, you know, from a memorized script. But, you know, when he's like, "You wouldn't lie to me, would you, Daddy?" You know, like, but it's still, you know, it still hits home, and I still think it's well played, and I it brings a smile to my face each time I see that.
I couldn't agree with you more, and I think one of the things that worked for me in that sequence, because I think you're right, it did feel more scripted, but it also felt kind of like he was regurgitating what Dad's told him for years.
Yes.
And then all of a sudden, Dad's got to say, am I going to tell him that everything I've taught him for years was wrong? Or am I going to, as a father, sit there and stand behind what I've been, you know, teaching my child along the way? So I thought the script, I agree with you, it felt scripted, but I felt it added that layer of he's repeating what's been scripted to him by his father since he was a, you know, young child. And I thought you're right, I thought that was a great sequence.
I hadn't thought about that one at all. I'm so glad you both brought it up, because I do chuckle during that scene. It's really funny, but I had not made any notes about it. So what a nice scene to bring up.
And the other aspect of the movie that I found interesting, you know, as I'm trying to dissect it a little bit, is you basically have he's not even a psychiatrist, whatever it is, the person who gives him the initial test, who's trying to, you know, he's basically the villain of the piece. He's trying to, you know, say that he's crazy and should be in an institution, and that's how this whole thing develops. But they show how this pressure on the other side, you know, at home for the DA, where his wife is giving him some grief for doing what he's doing. And then I thought having William Frawley, you know, who I guess we all know as Fred Mertz from I Love Lucy, as the advisor to the judge, the political advisor, who gives us, you know, who lays it out on, you know, basically the script is, this is why you're under pressure to find that this guy is Santa Claus. You know, mm-hmm. Look for an excuse to find it if you can, because otherwise you're going to kill your chances of re-election. And I think, you know, even though it's very exposition language, I think it's perfectly suited, because it's giving you another side to it that they don't have to waste time developing.
Right. That's a good, I think they handled that well.
Yeah. I mean, he's perfect for that role. And it's just, you know, the cigar chewing and, you know, this is politics. And, you know, he knows from the beginning that the guy needs to get out of the case. And then once, you know, the judge makes the silly mistake of going forward to it, he's always there, you know, winking and nodding or shaking his head, and, you know, the judge clues on what direction to go. It's just hilarious stuff.
It also makes it doesn't dumb down the film. It's a very smart choice. And that's one of the things I also like about this film is sometimes when you do like these quaint films like this, charming films like this, you almost they skirt a certain line of you can't get too heady in it. You can't start, exploring too many deep topics. And I thought that the political piece over that I thought really worked for this film. It added another layer to the reality of this film. And I thought it was an interesting sequence, and it was smart, which was something that I really appreciated about this film. I think this is also a very smart movie, and I think that makes it really enjoyable as well.
Well, such a good point, because I mean that's part of what makes this movie still feel real, because there are parts going on that are all about, you know, politics and getting reelected and the legal system and, you know, who is in authority. You have all that stuff going on in the background that keeps this movie grounded in reality while it's also convincing us that Santa Claus is real.
Yeah.
So I don't think there were any other actors or actresses that stood out and felt, you know, that I felt the need to discuss the performances. But before I move on to the direction, is there anybody else who you thought we should discuss?
I'll just mention one other person, sort of like Percy Helton when I heard his voice, is I had forgotten also in this movie until I heard the voice of the person who's sorting the mail that ended up being Jack Albert, who, you know, I know so much from later items of, you know, Willy Wonka and such. So it was just like, oh my goodness, there's, you know, him much younger than I've seen him, but the voice was so recognizable. It's just like Percy Helton that just jumped out. So I had like one at the beginning and one at the end that I was just like, oh, I forgot both of these people were in this movie.
The department store owners. I just got to shout them out only in the sense that I felt like the idea that this, it's almost the way that Santa Claus kind of tricked them into just by being himself into now all of a sudden being benevolent. And like now all of a sudden their stores are becoming more helpful. And if you go to a store and they don't have the product that you're looking for, we are going to help you find that product. And doesn't matter what store we're going to send you to. And now all of a sudden they're seeing record interest and record profits because of the fact that they're just being kind. I thought the way that they played that was so great, because the idea that at first when Macy was approached with this and he's sitting there and saying this is a risk, but he was intrigued by the risk. I thought it was again a very shrewd and very interesting scene. And it played out really, really well in this. And I also thought the fact that it was coming off of customer reaction to what was going on. So this is a department store owner who is reacting based on what feedback he's getting from customers that like, okay, we've got this crazy idea. And he thought it was being led by his people, not that like Santa Claus had taken this over. This was an initiative they put in. I just thought that was a really interesting premise surrounding the earlier parts of this film. There's so much going on in this that I think is just intriguing. I thought that was a layer that's pretty important. So I thought those owners, especially when they eventually met and they had that interaction around Santa Claus, and they still showed that like they're driven by, you know, certain amount of profit and prestige and those things. I thought they played those roles very, very well.
That's so true. I'm glad you discussed them because I hadn't thought about them, but they do, again, are so important to the movie. And it's so interesting that, you know, these two real large store chains let themselves be used in this movie. And not always, like you said, you know, they're there, they're shown they're doing it for profit still, even though they're doing the right thing. They're doing it because it's helping business. Mm-hmm. And, but it's interesting that Macy's and Gimbel's were okay with being used. And it's also interesting to me to watch this movie from 1947 and hear them say the same things that people say now about, you know, Christmas is too commercialized and it's all about, you know, profit and making money and everyone's forgotten the meaning of Christmas. And I'm thinking, you know, what everybody says now, and they were saying that same thing in 1947, and it's just very interesting parallel.
I agree with everything you both said, and I think it's a testament in largely to the direction of the movie, which is the next place I was going to go. Because the performances of those actors who play the store owners are fine. There's nothing wrong with them at all, but I think they benefit from the fact that George Seton, who directed this, did a real good job of pacing this movie and putting everything together in a way where it never feels like there's any kind of information dump, even though you have characters like William Frawley who are there purely for the purpose of information dump. It's just, you know, extremely well put together, and they give you that, and it helps to create the conflict in the story, because now Maureen O'Hara's character has a reason to want to champion Kris Kringle, even though she doesn't necessarily believe yet that he's really Santa Claus. Eventually she does come to believe it and understand it, but it's, you know, it gives the motivation for the characters, and it plays it really well. And I think, again, I think it's a testament to the direction in this movie. I think it really is well put together. I think my only criticism, again, and it's so minor, is that I think you could have changed some of the angles just to make Edmund Gwynn look a little bigger. But other than that, I wouldn't change a thing in this movie. And I looked up George Seton because I'm not really familiar with him by name, but he has directed a lot of significant movies that I heard of. And towards the end, the second to last movie he did was Airport, which is, I think, a great movie that we've reviewed on this show. I think his skills are on display in this movie, as well as the soundtrack. I'm going to combine them because I think, or the score rather, I think there's a Christmassy feel to the music, very similar in a lot of ways to what I think we got in It's a Wonderful Life. And I think it does help the feeling throughout the movie without overtaking it at any point.
Yeah, that's the direction's so good. I'm glad you looked up George Seton. I meant to and had forgotten to, so it's good to hear those things. The score, you're absolutely right, because it does exactly what the score should do, which is it's always there keeping your emotions in check at just the right times without overwhelming. And I also just want to mention the script too, because I think the script is very smart, and I was glad, you know, to see the person who wrote the original story then turned it into a novel, and I guess helped with the screenplay. But it has so much little witty dialogue. You know, Sean and I were talking a minute about the you know, commercial nature, and I love the fact that there's just little lines that are dropped in there, like the line about isms. That is really just insightful, including, you know, commercialism being maybe not necessarily a good one. And then I loved the one about how Kris Kringle tries to explain to Natalie Wood why, imagination's not a bad thing, and it's not that it's not real, it's just somewhere else. And I love the way he explained it by saying it's just another place, it's another nation, like the French nation, the British nation, and the imagination. And I just loved that line, and I just thought, oh, this script has so many witty little things in it that are also insightful.
Mm. Very true. So now I'm going to want to discuss the remakes and give a couple of minutes to each of those. But before we get to that, I think we should give what I think I already know are our ratings on this one. This is, in my mind, an absolute classic. It deserves to be watched every year, even though I've kind of put it into an every other year version. It's Jaws. This is a great movie as far as I'm concerned.
Absolutely. I second that. It is delightful, heartwarming, and I'm always happy to revisit it.
Yeah, I agree. It's definitely Jaws.
Yeah, like I said, I saw it in 2024, and oh my gosh, I want to watch it again already. And I don't say that lightly. I mean, I will watch it again this holiday season just because I really enjoyed it that much. This is definitely Jaws. If you have not seen this, you have to. It's and you have to see this version. I know we're going to talk about some of the other versions, but I cannot recommend highly enough that you see this version of the film.
Mm-hmm.
So now they remade this. The first one that I have on my list was from 1955, and it was part of the television series the 20th Century Fox Hour. And I actually looked for this, and I found it on YouTube streaming, and I watched it. So it's about a 45-minute version of the same story, and there's really no story beats that are changed. And the biggest critique I came away with, and I'm going to talk a little bit about the cast, but the biggest critique I came away with is that it's damaged by the fact that it's rushed. The entire story is put in 45 minutes, and I felt like it didn't give you the chance to latch onto the characters the way you needed to make this movie really work. It's enjoyable because if you already know the story, you can kind of just fill in the blanks on the characters, and it's interesting to see some of the different actors again, and I'll get into that in a moment. But again, I would not recommend this as the thing, as the first way to see this movie or this story. Have any of you ever seen this version?
I have not.
So the casting, McDonald Carey plays Fred Gailey, and I'm not really familiar with him. He's a soap opera actor. He was in an episode of Star Trek. So there's you can find things that you'd recognize him in, but I'm not particularly familiar with him. The most interesting choice, I thought, was in the Maureen O'Hara role of Doris Walker is Teresa Wright. Now, I know Teresa Wright from Shadow of a Doubt. I know Teresa Wright from The Pride of the Yankees. I know Teresa Wright from I Just Watched The Best Years of Our Lives, and some other things that I've seen her in over the years. I've always found her to be a very compelling actress with a lot of charisma, and I think she does a very good job with what she's given. Again, it feels rushed. It doesn't have the same depth as Maureen O'Hara's portrayal does, because I don't think she's given that opportunity. But she's fine, and I could see her in the original role. If she had been in the original movie, I don't think it really would have lost much, because I think she's on a par with Maureen O'Hara as far as acting ability and stage presence. The interesting thing I saw in it, well, there were two interesting things. Kris Kringle is played by Thomas Mitchell. Thomas Mitchell, you may be familiar with, was Uncle Billy in It's a Wonderful Life. He was also in Gone with the Wind and several other movies, but he plays Kris Kringle, and I would say a similar thing. I don't think he's as good as Edmund Gwynn. I don't think he would be as good, but he's still good in the role. And the other actor that jumped out at me that I recognized was Hans Conried as Mr. Shellhammer, who's the Macy's employee who works with Doris Walker. And just because his voice and his presence is just well known to me, so I thought it was kind of cool. But again, the movie felt just a little rushed, and that was the biggest problem I had.
Interesting.
Now, it was remade again in 1959 for the series NBC Friday Night Special Presentation. Now, I have not seen this one. And the names that jump out at me, and this one was 60 minutes long, so I guess it gave a little bit more chance, but again, I've never seen it. Ed Wynn played Kris Kringle in this. And I can picture Ed Wynn in the role, but I don't feel like he would be right for it. I feel he would be a little bit more hammy and over the top. I could be wrong. He may have given a wonderful performance because I haven't seen it, but he doesn't feel right in the casting to me. Any of you have any familiarity with this one?
No, I haven't seen that one either.
The other name that jumped out at me on this was Orson Bean as Dr. Sawyer, and you know, obviously a young Orson Bean, so that might have been interesting to be able to see. In 1973, they remade this again as a TV movie. And Sebastian Cabot, who you might know as Mr. French from Family Affair, or you might know him as Pip the Devil from The Twilight Zone, played Kris Kringle. I saw this when they first showed it in 1973 on TV. Alexander played the mom. David Hartman, who you might know from Good Morning America, played the, you know, the love interest, Fred Gailey. And then we had had a few more recognizable names. You had Roddy McDowall as Dr. Sawyer, Jim Backus as Shellhammer, David Doyle as R.H. Macy, Tom Bosley as the judge. So I haven't seen this in years, and I couldn't give you a critique of it, but I remember in 1973 as a young boy when I saw this, I enjoyed it, and I had already been familiar with the 1947 version and didn't feel like this took away from it at all. Have any of you seen this one?
Yeah, I'm like you, Paul. I saw this one back in the 70s as a kid when it was on. I was already a fan of Sebastian Cabot from, you know, Family Affair, so it was neat to see him in it. Like you said, it has several memorable people. I remember, like you, I already knew the original version. I remember seeing this version and liking it as a kid. I'll be absolutely honest, I haven't seen it in decades. So I, like you, would have no idea about critiquing it. I will say, though, interestingly, I have a good friend of mine who is a movie buff similar to all of us. This is his favorite version of the movie. He prefers this version, the 73 version, over the 47 version. I don't know if I've heard anybody else say that before, but certainly it has its fans, and it's one that he watches when he rewatches the movie. That's the version he watches.
The feeling I have, and again, it's been, as with you, a decade since I've seen this, but the feeling I have is that this was a very adequate remake, and that had it been the only version of it, it would be fine and fondly remembered. But I don't think it surpasses the original, and so the original still stays as the, you know, the version that is preferred. So
yeah, I would agree.
I think we can go with that. And then there is the most recent version, the 1994 version by John Hughes. And I have not seen this, and I do recognize a lot of the names that are in it. And Richard Attenborough as Kris Kringle is probably the one that jumps out at me. And I'm thinking, I'm picturing him as his role from Jurassic Park, but just put him in the Santa Claus role. And I'm seeing this as a much more maniacal version.
It's actually not. I watched the 94 version after seeing this one. I liked this one so much that I watched 94. It's a really good movie. I still, my fondness is for, and I'm glad I saw this version, the one that we reviewed first, just because I feel like that is my foundational version as far as that piece goes. But the 1994 version is actually it's a good movie. It's worth seeing. It's very well cast. A lot of the comments that we gave on this one as far as casting, I think, work for that film as well. It's a little bit longer, actually. But there's something so special about this version that we've reviewed that I'm glad I saw it. I would watch it again, actually, the 94 version, if it was on. It was because it's set in a very different time. I mean, like, you can feel that it's a different era and different time. Also, it's not a shot for shot remake, which I always appreciate, because I think sometimes when you do that, you're trying to be the other film instead of trying to be a modern interpretation of the story. And so I think it works very well because it's not trying to be this film. It's trying to be its own thing, while at the same time keeping all of the appropriate themes. I really enjoyed it. It's a really good cast, and it's worth seeing. This is still the one that I'm going to watch next is going to be the original Miracle on 34th Street Prime. It's going to be the one that I think I'm going to watch next. But the 1994 version, if you are remotely interested, it's not a waste of time. It's worth seeing.
I'm glad you've seen it recently, Sean. I, similar to the 73 version that I remember seeing decades ago and liking, I remember seeing this one back in the 90s. I don't remember if I saw it in the cinema or not, or if I saw it on, you know, TV later. But I do remember seeing that one and, again, liking it. I remember liking it, and sort of similar to what you were saying just a moment, Paul, if that was the only version, then you would love it. But this version, the 47 version, is just pure magic from beginning to end. So, you know, as good as the 94 version is, I'm like you, Sean. The 47 version is always the one that calls to me when I want to rewatch Miracle on 34th Street.
Yeah, what I read in looking into these was that the 1994 version is an update of it in the 1994 modern sensibilities. It's hard to believe that's 30 years ago already. But what I read, at least in a critique, was that it lacks the timeless element of the 1947 movie that makes it always a classic. It feels like a movie of its time, whereas 1947 just feels timeless. So, I didn't see this, so I'm basing this on what I've read. I'm not going to try and say that that was my feeling.
I'd agree with that, though. Having watched it, it does feel like, you know, 1994, the timeless piece. I think you're right. I think that's the reason why I do consider the version that we reviewed to be much more of the prime version of it, just in the sense that I think it really, you can watch it now and it feels like you're opening and enjoying a very modern storybook. Whereas the 1994 version is a good film, but it's a 1994 film. It's John Hughes. Here's the thing. It's John Hughes.
You have an idea of what to expect.
Yeah. So, I mean, if you're a fan of John Hughes films, you're not going to be disappointed. It's a really good John Hughes film. And I do recommend it from that perspective. But it's funny, now I'm going to have to go, at some point I'm going to have to watch it again with you putting Jurassic Park in my head.
So I guess, you
hopefully
know,
there's at least a kid opening a dinosaur toy somewhere in the movie.
So I guess the bottom line, though, is while each version has its merits, the 1947 version is the gold standard, and that's the one we're all recommending to you as strongly as we can. It's a Christmas classic and should be treated as such. I just want to wish Sean, Darren, and Ruth all a Merry Christmas, as well as everybody who's listening to this. And thank you guys for coming on and spending a little Christmas with me.
This was wonderful. Thank you.
Yes, thank you both for letting us spend our holidays with you.
This is really fun.
And thank you, everybody, for listening. Merry Christmas, and we'll see you in 2 weeks in 2025.
Well, young lady, what's your name?
I'm sorry, she doesn't speak English. She's Dutch. She just came over. She's been living in an orphan's home in Rotterdam ever since, well, we've adopted her. I told her you wouldn't be able to speak to her, but when she saw you in the parade yesterday, she said you were Santa Claus, as she calls you, and you could talk to her. Well, I didn't know what to do.
Hello, ich bin blij, dat je gekomen bent.
Oh, Ben Santa Claus.
Yes, I
guess I existed, Bill. Ich was zeker dat u het zou begrijpen.
Natuurlijk. Zeg maar wat je zou willen hebben van Sinterklaas.
Niks. Ik heb van alles. Ik wil alleen maar bij deze lieve dame zijn.
Wil je wat voor mij zingen?
Sinterklaas kapoentje, geef het in mijn schoentje. Geef het in mijn laarsje. Dank u Sinterklaasje. Sinterklaas kapoentje, geef wat in mijn schoentje. Geef wat in mijn laarsje. Dank.